First of all, I apologize because the sound isn't the best tonight. You might say the picture's lousy too, but can't do anything about that. So when we get to some of the passages then on the screen, I'll probably ask someone to read those so that I can spare my voice. And just to let you know, this is going to be a look at the bankruptcy of science or surrounding present day scientific thought. When we come back 2 weeks from now, we'll have a little more analytic view of Genesis 1, and we'll get back into the scientific stuff there. So we'll get started here. The question is, what is true? Now, what is the definition of truth to begin with? We have a society that has different truths, your truth, my truth, and so on. But what is the actual bottom line meaning of truth?
That which corresponds with reality.
That which corresponds to reality. You remember that from Dr. Del Tackett. That which is evident from what we see around us is the truth. And so keep that in mind. We're going to pick up a few little threads at the beginning, which will all come together later. But I'm going to tell you about a man by the name of G. Richard Bogarth. Richard was raised in a Christian family in the U.S. At a young age, he said he was born again twice. And he got baptized and showed real promise, study of the scriptures, etc. And then something happened. His mom and dad got divorced, and he was taken to the other side of the continent, over to California. He was all by himself. No friends anymore, new school. He became a loner, and he considered himself a free thinker. And in the free thinking, he linked up with Madeline O'Hare, you've heard the name, and she's a radical atheist. And he became the editor of the Free Thinking magazine. And in 1979, this is his statement, and this is to back up what Jason said 2 weeks ago. Evolution destroys utterly and finally the very reason Jesus' earthly life was supposedly made necessary. Destroy Adam and Eve, and the original sin, and the rubble you will find, the sorry remains of the Son of God. If Jesus was not the Redeemer who died for our sins, and this is what evolution means, then Christianity is nothing. One thing I'll say about it, he knows that evolution destroys Christianity. You take away Genesis 1, we have nothing. We might as well go home. He understood that. He's still alive, I understand. We can only hope that what he learned when he was young will come back to him and he'll repent. But many of these men and women that we will look at today, it's too late for them. They've already gone. But when you think of science, a lot of our early scientists were actually believers in God. Here's Johannes Kepler, who was an astronomer and mathematician. The chief aim of all investigations of the eternal world should be to discover the rational order and harmony which has been imposed on it by God and which he revealed to us in the language of mathematics. Yay, mathematics. A lot of science is based on mathematics. But he wasn't the only one. There's an awful lot of them. I've got a list here of 38. And you can recognize a lot of these. Francis Bacon, Galileo, Kepler, Boyle, Euler, mathematician, Faraday, some of electronics is named after him, go down to Greg Mendel, having to do with gene theory and so on, inheritance, down to Isaac Newton there. Probably not many of you have heard that name before, right? Carl Linnaeus down at the bottom, he classified various plant classifications and so on. Carl Friedrich Gauss, a clever, clever mathematician. A lot of funny stories about him. And Florence Nightingale, what's she doing there? She's a nurse. She used statistics to be able to improve the lifespan of people. She improved the lifespan of people in her lifetime by 20 years just because of doing statistics on her patients. Pascal, another mathematician, and down to Samuel Morse of Morse Code. And as I look online, there are hundreds of men and women who believe that God was involved in creation, and major scientists like this. Now, I won't say they're all believers. Some are Unitarian, some are deists, and I'll have to be careful. Some are Catholic. I can't say, not saying that people can't be Christians when they're Catholic, but a lot of them believe in a salvation of works, which is not good. So, but some of them were born-again believers. And they all said, in various ways, they can study science because they know it was a God of order who created the order that we live in. And therefore, when they investigate things, they know that it's always going to be the same. It's not going to be chaos. And here are some of the statements they would make. He can be worshipped in the cathedral or in the laboratory. Or here's Louis Pasteur. You've heard that name before. Every time we drink a glass of milk. Science brings men closer to God. Or Robert Boyle, from a knowledge of his work, we shall know him. They all, you have statements like this, that this is creation pointing out who God is. And therefore, yes?
Not all of them believe in like a six-day creation, right?
Possibly not. I think Darwin himself would have confessed that there is a God, but he wanted to circumvent his action in creation. But yeah, you're right there. And we're going to get back to that in 2 weeks.
Jerry had pointed out to me Francis Collins is on that as well.
Who's that?
Francis Collins. He also doesn't believe in it. Francis Collins doesn't believe in a six-day creation either.
No. What is science? We're only picking up these threads because it's going to come back to haunt us. This is from the Oxford Dictionary. The systematic study of structure and behavior of the physical natural world through observation, experimentation, the testing of theories against the evidence obtained. Okay, those are important words. Observation, experimentation, testing of theories. And this is the scientific process. You come up with a hypothesis. You're sitting under a tree and an apple falls on your head. So there's the hypothesis, apples fall on heads. And then you notice another apple falls and it misses your head. Well, apples fall then. And then the pear tree falls, and apples and pears, and so on. And you keep improving your hypothesis until you come to a point where you think you've got it all covered, everything falls, but you're not sure. When you're at that point, it's a theory, but it still has to be tested and tried in different things. And eventually, if you're not really sure that it's going to be true all the time, it's still a theory. But if you know it's always going to be true, no matter where you do it or whatever, it's called a law. And that's why we have things like the law of gravity, Newton's second law of thermodynamics. There are laws, Boyle's law. These things are always going to be true no matter where you are or what your circumstance you're in. So remember those words because we're going to come back to haunt us too. Someone read this from Psalm 19, please, out loud.
The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world.
What does that tell you?
That his creation speaks of God. Creation speaks of God.
And loudly, right?
Not knowing God.
Pardon?
There's no excuse for not knowing God.
It's loud. Declares, proclaims, pours out speech, reveals knowledge, speech, words, voice, right? And we're going to come back to that idea in a few minutes. So, how do we understand the cosmos? Like, when people think of this world, do they think of it as proclaiming God? When you look at the stars, we go up to our cottage, there's no street lights or anything, so at night the skies are amazing, and especially when the northern lights are dancing and they actually sing, you can hear the well, it humbles you to think that God has done all this. You have that feeling. It points to a God. And what we're saying is God is transcendent, which means he's outside of the earth, outside of this cosmos, outside of everything we know, doing his work here. Whereas there's another point of view, and that is this cosmos is creating itself. Those are the two battlegrounds. And that's what the battleground is between so-called science and faith. So, we all know Romans 1, we've had it a couple weeks ago, we're going to read it again tonight, because this is the other side of those who reject what we saw in Psalm 19. So if someone wouldn't mind, we've got two screens here to read, so we'll start with the first one.
For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse.
God says that it's plain. He has made it plain to them. He's shown it to them. Us. Shown it to us. His invisible attributes are clearly perceived. Finish it off, please.
For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, and creeping things. Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever.
We would say, well, we don't worship gods like animals and things like that. We do. Our culture does. Our culture is a god. Has a god, I should say, of creation. That's why all this push for carbon control and so on. We're worshiping our creation. God says that they are worshiping the creature rather than the creator. So, where did the cosmos come from? Let's start with the beginning. Has it always existed, or does it have a beginning? Let's start with the first one. If it always existed, what's the problem with that?
It's eternal.
Hmm?
That would mean it's eternal.
It's eternal, that's right. always into the eternal. And what's the big problem with that?
It's constantly in death.
Newton's second law of thermodynamics, it's a law. It's not argued by anyone. It says that the universe is in a state of entropy, which means that it's constantly winding down, losing energy. If that's going on for eternity, where would it be now? Dead, right? We wouldn't be here. Because it's always been. So if it had a beginning then, what's the problem there?
How did it get here?
How did it start? Well, we've heard of the Big Bang. Now, that's easy to say. Can you imagine the energy that was expended in that Big Bang that they claim? Where did that come from? Energy doesn't appear out of nowhere. It had blown, they're saying, these galaxies thousands and millions of light years away and still moving. It's just pie in the sky. There's no observation, experimentation, and so on. They just make the proclamation without evidence. And there's a reason for it, as we will see. We know it had a beginning, Genesis 1 and 1. But the general consensus of science today is that it's not true. So, here's another little thread that we have to look at. Sorry.
What did you say the general consensus of science is? What did you say the general consensus of science is?
Is that the Big Bang.
Oh, right? But there is a beginning, right?
The general consensus. Oh, yeah. We're going to see some strange statements, though, on the other side.
It's interesting to note when the Big Bang theory was being proposed, most scientists rejected it because they believed the universe had existed forever. And the Big Bang sounded too much like Genesis 1 to them.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Oh, that means it had a beginning. I guess we have other questions to answer. Yeah. They didn't want to have to answer those questions.
Not many scientists will accept that the universe has always been, because it's too big a problem. So they're stuck with the Big Bang. You know? Yeah, you're right. Man by the name of William Paley. He came from Peterborough, by the way. Back in the 18th century. Peterborough, England. He was a clergyman, a theologian, and he wrote a book called Natural Theology. And in it, he argued that just as a watch is a complex and intricate mechanism that implies the existence of a watchmaker, if you found it on the ground, you wouldn't think it just sort of came together. You'd think, looking at it, it's obviously been designed by somebody, a watchmaker. Right? That's his argument. The natural world is also a complex and intricate mechanism, and that implies the existence of a divine creator. Well, that didn't sit well with some scientists. There's a more recent theologian by the name of Richard Dawkins. We're going to see him a little bit today. He's still alive in England. And he wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker. And he said, natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process, which Darwin discovered and which we now know as the explanation for the existence and apparent purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind, has no mind, no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of a watchmaker in nature, it's the blind watchmaker. Now, I don't even really know what he's saying, I'm sorry. but what he's saying is, nature can do what we say a watchmaker or intelligent design did. Richard Dawkins is not a nice man in most cases. Here's Julian Huxley. Yes.
Yeah, really quick, go back to that really good. What's interesting is what he's pushing back against there. I mean, it's so obvious with the second part of his quote.
Yeah.
Is any intelligent design or purpose?
Yeah.
What he doesn't realize is the contradiction that is just so clear, right?
Mm-hmm.
When there is, even as he has said at times, well, we have to acknowledge that there's some order.
Yeah. Purposeful.
Exactly. Directly contradicts himself. That's kind of the corner you paint yourself in.
Yeah,
right?
And we're going to get into that in 2 weeks. This little, they don't see their contradiction in their argument.
It's crazy.
That's right, that's good. So, Julian Huxley, astronomer. Darwin's theory is no longer a theory, but a fact. Darwinianism has come of age, so to speak. We're no longer having to bother about having to establish the fact of evolution. Now, he's not saying it's a law. He's just saying it's a fact. Isaac Asimov, you probably know him from science fiction. Here's some more. Today, although many educators play it safe by calling evolutionary ideas theory instead of fact, there's no reputable biologist who doubts that species, including Homo sapiens, that you mean, have developed with time, and that they're continually, though slowly, changing. And if they do doubt, they're not reputable anymore and they get canceled. That's why, right? The only ones they'll recognize that are reputable are the ones that accept evolution. Here's Carl Sagan. We're going to see a lot of him. Evolution is a fact amply demonstrated by the fossil record and contemporary molecular biology. Natural selection is a successful theory devised to explain the fact of evolution. And then we have Richard Dawkins back here again. He says it's absolutely safe to say, this hurts. If you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked. But I'd rather not consider that. You know what he thinks of us, eh?
Yeah.
Are these the quotes, are they fairly recent quotes? Do you know the dating?
Yes. This one is from his book, Put Your Money on Evolution. I got all of these off the internet.
Because I follow Answers in Genesis, it's a really good website, and I just heard recently from a podcast I listened to like maybe 2 weeks ago that they've recently just blown that whole theory right out of the park with current DNA discoveries and also the fossil thing with soft tissue.
The blow the theory of?
Of all of these people, what they're saying, you know, the
evolution. Well, of course, yeah, they have.
How current these quotes are, because now they've all kind of been debunked from what the Answers in Genesis.
Well, if you go by Ben Stein's interview with Richard Dawkins in the movie Expelled, he's not letting go. He's doubling down on it, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And Michael Ruse, like, yeah, they're all still doubling down, and we'll show you why in a few minutes.
Also, I think while evaluating sources, it's important to know that every person on each side of the table is going to say that they debunked the other person completely, right? So Ken Ham, like, although yes, we do believe that evolution is not true, Ken Ham has claimed that it's been debunked from the beginning, right? So we kind of have to take his claims with a pinch of salt to say, like, the scientific community is not going to say, oh yeah, it's debunked, okay, let's move on. They're not going to say that. So both sides always claim that they've debunked the other side.
If you see what comes out in this video here, in academia, people who believe in evolution, or who don't believe in evolution, who believe in creation, are actually canceled from academia. They're, even though they're tenured, they are let go. So I don't think there's much change in the recent. then they say it's a fact. Now, here's a college textbook. The theory, oh, that's an of. Theory of evolution is no less, my typing, no less reliable than the atomic theory or the germ theory of infectious diseases. As with atoms, which cannot be directly observed, we cannot directly observe the production of new species by evolution. Notice they admit there's no observation. Biologists have gathered tremendous amounts of evidence in support of biological evolution. However, and not one major piece of evidence has ever been obtained that suggests it's not occurred. Conversely, the so-called theory of creationism proposes no testable hypothesis and thus cannot be proven right or wrong. Proponents simply accept it on faith. We're the only ones that have faith, notice that. The theory of evolution, however, suggests many predictions that can be tested. So let's start and have a look at the process. There's three aspects that we're going to look at. How did life start? And the evidence for the gradual development from simple to complex forms. So how does it stack up against her? Here's Francis Crick. I don't know whether you know this name or not, but he's the one who was a co-discoverer of the DNA back in the 60s or 50s. A clever man. And he says, an honest man armed with all the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to been satisfied to get going. He admits it's a miracle. What's his solution? It's something called, there we are, directed panspermia. And it's the theory that the first living cell must have been transported to Earth from some other planet outside our solar system. Now think about that. We know where our solar system is. Do you know the closest star to our sun? Proxima Centauri, 4.5 light years away, right? Means that light takes 4.5 years to come from there. So somehow or other, this planet, which might have come from him, from that solar system, they sent a rocket with one little cell to drop on Earth. Now, if it came by way of an asteroid, we know that it's burnt up on the way through. So this, Ben Stein's really funny in this. He pushes Richard Dawkins on this. And Richard Dawkins says, it had to be a civilization that was very highly developed. And he said that they sent this sperm cell, whatever it was, this original cell, to the Earth and started off one cell on the Earth. And Ben says, it couldn't have been God. Oh no, it can't be God. You don't believe in God. No, you don't believe in any God? No. The Hindu God? You go on like this. He says there had to be a highly developed civilization on a planet not in our solar system. Who has the faith? Right? We're the ones that.
The candle of the road. Like, where did they start? Like, how did they?
Well, there's the other thing. They're now pushing it back more billions of years.
Yeah, many more.
Saying that, how long did that civilization take to be highly developed? That's the problem, because time is the hero, right?
A planet, some other planet outside our solar system. Where did our solar system come from? Right?
Well, that's from the Big Bang. Right?
But, yeah.
They're still claiming the Big Bang. It's just not logically possible. This is a clever man. He got the Nobel Prize. And this is his theory. Now, it's a theory, but they haven't even tested it. It's only not even a hypothesis. And we'll get into that in 2 weeks' time.
David, wouldn't you say too, you know, when you think about Francis Crick, like you say, Nobel Prize, smart man, this is anthropology, right, 101. When you deny creator, there's no bounds
no.
at how
Here's George Wald. He studied eye pigments. That's his thing, right? So he's an expert. Most modern biologists, having reviewed the satisfaction, the downfall of spontaneous generation hypothesis. Now, when you were in science, you probably learned about this because you saw a piece of meat and all of a sudden life came out of it and it was spontaneously generated. And then they realized if you put it in a jar and cover it, the life didn't come up, and they realized it was fly's eggs, right, that were hatching. But so scientists now know that spontaneous generation of life does not happen and could not happen. And there's all kinds of biological and chemical reasons why we can't get into tonight. They've even tried experiments with lightning on or high voltage on stuff. It doesn't work because it creates the wrong stuff. Anyway, reviewed with satisfaction, in other words, they accept the fact that spontaneous generation is not possible, yet unwilling to accept the alternative belief in special creation, are left with nothing. I think a scientist has no choice but to approach the origin of life through a hypothesis of some spontaneous generation. And here he goes. One has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede spontaneous generation of a living organism as possible. Yet here we are. As a result, I believe in spontaneous generation. This is a clever, clever man.
I think it was Carl Sagan who said, we have to give up spontaneous generation. Now we have to believe in gradual spontaneous generation.
Oh, is that right?
And that brings to mind, I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said, a slow miracle is still a miracle.
Yeah, that's right. It
doesn't take it out of the realm of fantastic just because you're out of time.
That's right. Who has the faith now? Science has no answers for the origin of life. None. It's remarkable there's no suggestion of the origin of botanical life, that is, plants and trees. They talk about animal life, but these both had to start together because they're symbiotic, right? They have to feed on each other. Or the evaporation, which is just a versus animal life. They both have to originate together because it's a symbiotic relationship. So they seem to be concentrating on animal life. We know the answer, Genesis 1. Anyway, that's the bankruptcy in the origins. They don't have any answers that are logical or scientific. Carl Sagan's statement earlier said, evolution is a fact amply demonstrated by the fossil record and contemporary molecular biology. So let's look at that. We're going to start with molecular biology. That's not my expertise in science, but I understand enough of it. But here are his conditions that he said that we would get into. This, by the way, comes from Carl Sagan wrote a book in 78 called Cosmos. And then in about 79 or 80, he put together a 13-episode documentary called Cosmos that was on public television. It was the highest viewed documentary on public television ever. And the one that we saw earlier about I forget it now, but that came from the beginning. This is part of the dialogue in this documentary. I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand the cosmos. We wish to pursue the truth no matter where it leads. But to find the truth, we need imagination and skepticism both. We will not be afraid to speculate, but we will be careful to distinguish between speculation and fact. Sometimes they're not very honest. So, let's see what Darwin's conditions were. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. We're going to talk about something called irreducible complexity. Here is a very complex instrument. There are 9 parts to it. There's the baseboard, and there's 4 staples. Then there's the dinner plate, the neck breaker,
aww,
and this little rod, the trip. This one is missing one part. This one staple, it's useless. This is an example of irreducible complexity. You can't have one part missing and still have it work, right? Now, imagine this is a living organism. The mouse thought over the last 1/100th of a second before he, that was life, right? He thought it was living. But if, suppose it's a living organism that needs all 9 of these parts. And in its development, how does it get here if it's missing one part before it gets here, right? Do you understand the argument? You can't have it just appear with all 9 parts, and yet if it's developing as an organism, it can't start off with all 9 of them because they're starting from one cell, right, and building up. So irreducible complexity is the argument that Darwin didn't even know about, and therefore probably wouldn't have proposed his theory. So we're going to look at a video clip from something called Unlocking the Mysteries of Life, a really interesting video. It tells about a number of scientists who were called together to a symposium on the West Coast, California, to be able to talk openly about how that we can answer how life got here without using evolution. These are not necessary believers, but they realize the bankruptcy of evolution. And as they met together, they came up with, and you've heard the term, intelligent design. This was 1993. And since then it has been of course exposed to the world. Some of the men here you will see in the video here and 2 weeks from now. Watch for a man by the name of Michael Behe. Michael Behe was a scientist, a biologist, and when he graduated from university, he went on, got his doctorate in biology. And while he was practicing his doctorate and whatever he was doing in the lab, he had a student came to him with a book that proposed an alternative to evolution. He said he'd never heard of it before. He just thought evolution was true because he was always told it was. He just blindly accepted it. And he got to thinking about it, and he realized how wrong it was. And he responded the same way as Dean Kenyon and a bunch of others to saying, yeah, this world looks like it's intelligent design. So this clip is going to expose you to some of these men. Unfortunately, we couldn't get it to work the way we wanted it to, so I'm going to have to shut this off and come back here in a few minutes. I didn't want to do that.
Until you have all those parts in place.
The irreducible complexity of molecular machines poses a severe challenge to the power of natural selection. According to Darwin's theory, even very complex biological structures like an eye, an ear, or a heart can be built gradually over time in small incremental steps. Yet, as Darwin made clear, natural selection can only succeed if these random genetic changes provide some advantage to the evolving organism in its struggle for survival.
As I have attempted to show, it is not necessary to suppose that the modifications were all simultaneous if they were extremely slight and gradual. Natural selection is scrutinizing the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, preserving and adding up all that are good.
But could Darwin's small, favorable variations have produced a bacterial flagellum? Some scientists doubt the possibility.
How could something new, like a bacteriophlagellar motor and all the components that go with it, how could it develop out of a population of bacteria that don't have that system? When each change, according to Darwin's theory, has to provide some kind of advantage.
Imagine such a scenario early in the Earth's history. An evolving bacterium somehow develops a tail and perhaps even the pieces necessary to attach it to the cell wall. Yet without a complete motor assembly, this innovation would provide no advantage to the cell. Instead, the tail would lie immobile and useless, invisible to natural selection, which by definition can only favor changes that aid survival.
The logic of natural selection is very demanding. Unless the flagellum mechanism is completely assembled and actually works, natural selection simply cannot preserve it. It cannot be passed on to the next generation.
The important thing to realize about natural selection is it selects only for a functional advantage. In most cases, natural selection actually eliminates things that have no function or that have a function that harms the organism. So if you had a bacterium with a tail that didn't function as a flagellum, chances are natural selection would eliminate it. The only way you can select for a flagellum is if you have a flagellum that works, and that means you have to have all the pieces of the motor in place to begin with. So natural selection can't get you the bacterial flagellum. It can only work after the flagellum is there and operating.
In 1996, Michael Behe published a book titled Darwin's Black Box. In it, he argued that natural selection, Darwin's designer substitute, could not explain the origin of the bacterial flagellum or any other irreducibly complex biological system. Instead, Behe concluded that the integrated complexity of these systems pointed to intelligent design. Darwin's black box created immediate controversy. Over 75 publications, including some of the world's leading newspapers and scientific journals, reviewed the book. Some scientists praised Behe's work, while others dismissed it as unscientific and religiously motivated. Behe's critics also insisted that he had underestimated the power of natural selection. They argued that the flagellar motor could have been constructed from parts used to build simpler molecular machines, like this needle-nose cellular pump. If the components of the pump already existed, they could have been preserved by natural selection even before the bacterial motor arose. This theory is called co-option.
It's essentially saying that evolution or natural selection at some point was able to borrow components of one molecular machine and build a new machine with some of these components.
Scott Minnick has studied the flagellar motor for nearly 20 years. His research has led him to challenge the co-option argument.
With a bacterial flagellum, you're talking about a machine that's got 40 structural parts. Yes, we find 10 of them are involved in another molecular machine, but the other 30 are unique. So where are you going to borrow them from? Eventually, you're going to have to account for the function of every single part is originally having some other purpose. So you can only follow that argument so far until you run into the problem of you're borrowing parts from nothing. But even if you concede that you have all the parts necessary to build one of these machines, that's only part of the problem. Maybe even more complex, I think more complex, is the assembly instructions. That is never addressed by opponents of the irreducible complexity argument.
Studies of the bacterial motor have indeed revealed an even deeper level of complexity. For its construction not only requires specific parts, but also a precise sequence of assembly.
You've got to make things at the right time. You've got to make the right number of components. You've got to assemble them in a sequential manner. You've got to be able to tell if you've assembled it properly so that you don't waste energy building a structure that's not going to be functional.
Building a molecular machine has been compared to the construction of a house, where workers follow a detailed blueprint and plan for assembly. The foundation of a house is poured before the walls are erected. Plumbing and electrical fixtures are installed prior to enclosing the walls of the structure. Windows must be hung before siding is applied, and shingles are attached only after plywood sheets are nailed to the rafters. So it is with the construction of a flagellar motor.
You build this structure from the inside out. You're counting the number of components in a ring structure or the stator. And once that's assembled, there's feedback that says, okay, no more of that component. Now a rod is added, a ring is added, another rod is added, U-joints added. Once U-joints at a certain size and a certain degree of bend, about a quarter turn, that's shut off, and then you start adding components for the propeller. These are all made in a precise sequence, just like you would build a building.
To build a motor correctly requires a complex system of machines that coordinate the timing of the assembly instructions. But how could natural selection construct such a system?
The co-option argument doesn't explain this. You see, in order to construct that flagellar mechanism, or tens of thousands of other such mechanisms in the cell, you require other machines to regulate the assembly of these structures. And those machines themselves require machines for their assembly.
If even one of these pieces is missing or put in the wrong place, your motor isn't going to work. So this apparatus to assemble the flagellar motor is itself irreducibly complex. In fact, what we have here is irreducible complexity all the way down.
We know a lot about the bacterial flagellum. We still have a lot to learn, but we know a lot about it. And there's no explanation for how this complex molecular machine was ever produced by a Darwinian mechanism.
150 years ago, scientists did not know about irreducibly complex molecular machines. Yet Charles Darwin anticipated the difficulty that systems such as these could pose to his theory.
If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down.
They explain it better than I could. So this is Behe says to Darwin, the cell was a black box. Its inner workings were utterly mysterious to him. Now the black box has been opened up, we know how it works. Applying Darwin's test to the ultra complex world of molecular machinery and cellular systems that have been discovered over the past 40 years, we can say that Darwin's theory has absolutely broken down. And they're talking about tens of thousands of different things that are irreducibly complex. Even consider your eye or your internal organs. They don't work unless they're all there. You can't start off with part of them. Here's Dr. Wickramasinghe says, the speculations of the origin of species turned out to be wrong. It's ironic that the scientific facts throw Darwin out, but leave William Paley, a figure of fun to the scientific world for more than a century, still in the tournament with a chance of being the ultimate winner. We don't have a lot of time to go into that, but that gives you an idea of why molecular biology does not point to evolution. It cannot. The fossil record is the same. We'll just take a few minutes. This won't take very long. This is Darwin admitting it himself. He says the geological record is extremely imperfect, and this fact will to a large extent explain why we do not find interminable varieties connecting together all the extinct and existing forms by the finest graduated steps. He who rejects these views on the nature of the geological record will rightly reject my whole theory. He also, now here's Colin Patterson. He's an evolutionist, a paleontologist, in other words, a guy who looks at fossils, from the London Museum of Natural History. He says, I will lay it on the line. There is not one such transitional fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. He wrote that in a private letter to a man by the name of Luther Sullivan Sutherland, who was a creationist. Then David Rope, he's the director of Field Museum of Natural History, one of the largest fossil collections in the world. He wrote this in a bulletin called the Field Museum of Natural History, January 1979. Well, we're now about 120 years after Darwin. The knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We now have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. The record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky, and ironically, we still have even fewer examples of evolutionary transitions than we had in Darwin's time. Stephen Jay Gould, another paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as a trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary tree that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. And what he's talking about, this is Darwin's tree, and at the top you see all the present life forms, and then the nodes where they come together are the suggestions of what animal was their great-grandfather or whatever. And he says, we don't have any of the intermediate stuff. So Stephen Gould says, we fancy ourselves as the only true students of life history, yet to preserve our favorite account of evolution by natural selection, we view our data as so bad that we never see the very process we profess to study. I wish only to point out that it was never seen in the rocks. So what does he say? Punctuated equilibrium. What's that mean? On the left would be a traditional evolutionary process where things gradually got more complex as time went on. He says that as time goes on, it stays level and then it jumps, and a whole bunch of changes all at once. And then it stays level for a while, and then it jumps with a whole bunch of changes. And his evidence for that is that there is none. There's no evidence. So it must happen quickly.
Just one jump, though.
Yeah.
From nothing to something.
Yeah, just like that. So in other words, horses become whatever, all at once. These are clever people. Anyway, here's a man, Jonathan Wells. You saw him a little earlier with the graying beard. He wrote a book called Icons of Evolution, and a video came out on it too, where he talks about all of the major icons that you've seen in your science classes, and these are some of them. And he debunks every one of them. At least he bunks every one. What do you call it? Where They say because all the skeletons have the same pattern, therefore they must have come from the same ancestor. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't they have the same designer? Mm-hmm. Haeckel's embryos, he actually drew them dishonestly. They weren't what he showed. And even if they do look alike, could be a common creator, right? Mm-hmm. The four-winged fruit fly never existed. It was specially bred in the lab. The moths on the tree, the pepper moths, they were pinned there for the photograph. They never land on trees. They land on flat surfaces. You know, there's all kinds of dishonest stuff that was taught in the school, and I read where someone says, yeah, I know they were wrong, but they teach the principles we're trying to... Anyway, so Soren Lovtrup, a Danish man who works in Sweden, says, I believe that one day the Darwinian myth will be ranked as the greatest deceit in the history of science. When this happens, many will pose the question, how did this ever happen? Here's Carl Sagan. We saw him earlier. He says he's going to follow
the evidence wherever it leads.
Wherever it leads you, right? And they're going to distinguish speculation from fact. He's passed away in 96, so it's too late for him.
No, actually, he didn't. Mm-hmm. He didn't lead to the evidence.
Pardon?
When he died, he was led to the evidence.
He changed his theology.
Yeah.
They all did. Evolution is a fact amply demonstrated by the fossil record and contemporary molecular biology. I don't know where they have to. Here's Richard Dawkins, you remember? We're wicked, mm-hmm. or ignorant, or stupid, or insane. Mm. This is in the God delusion. This is what he read to Ben Stein on this video. He says, this is my opinion of the Old Testament God. He said, the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all of fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, felicitato, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, and capriciously malevolent bully. He stands in the judge of the Almighty God. It's like going into, well, not even like, but going into a courtroom and the perpetrator of the deed is judging the judge. It's worse than that. He still has time. He's still alive.
He actually changed his tune about this when confronted with Islam and the spread of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
He did say that Western civilization needs Christianity. So he very, very recently, like maybe 4 years ago.
What did he say?
That when confronted with like the spread of Islam, he said that Western civilization needs Christianity.
Just like this.
Oh, right.
He did. Yeah, so he's changed his tune about this. Compared to Allah, this God is good.
Oh. Well, in this video, he said he doesn't believe in any God, of any religion. He said he can't exist. So I hope he does search for the truth, because although he's done a lot of damage, there's still time for him. Someone read this, please, for us.
The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. They became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creation, the creature rather than the creator, who is blessed forever.
Thank you. It's an awful sentence that he brings on people. So, what is true? Any other comments or questions?
Just seeing that last one, and the Romans one, of course, we talked about that so many times. You know, that is just so wonderfully enlightening. But Dawkins, at the end of Expelled, I don't know if you've seen it, he has a very telling quote that reveals Romans 1. So Ben Stein says to him, you know, Richard, if you had God here, what would you say to him? And Richard Dawkins has a moment where he's just reflecting and he says, you know what I would say? I'd say, why did you go to so much trouble not to reveal yourself to us? But isn't that telling? That's exactly what Richard, in a very real moment, he says, why did you go? And you know, you can only have pity in that moment. He's blind. He's absolutely blind. You know what I mean? So, yeah, this is so good, David. I mean, it's just a real boiling it down to that. They just can't see it. Absolutely.
No. You notice, we're not dealing with a battle of the Bible and science. It's not science. The battle is an evil against good. It is to try and annihilate the recognition of God from our culture. It has nothing to do with science, but they've chosen science as the topic. So that's where the battle is. We don't have to be afraid of science. True science is something we should support and encourage.
What about the science?
What about that?
The science.
I'm not hearing you, I'm sorry.
The science. Because everyone claims like there's something called the science as well, right?
The science?
Yeah. Like, the science proves that masking is or the science. Because people claim science is like a body of truth.
Oh, I see.
Process, as opposed to a process of discovery.
Yeah.
Right?
So
science is a process.
It's a process. That's right. It's continually examining, observing, and testing hypotheses. So there isn't a fixed science. It's always changing. You're right.
David.
Yes.
You see in the modern scientists there is, so they talk about facts, right?
Yeah.
And we can often be intimidated by, oh, there's a fact,
right?
That they say this is a fact, we have to deal with it. But they're calling it a fact because they're, at the outset, they're ruling out certain explanations.
Yes.
Like, just... Because everybody has these starting principles, right? And their starting principle is everything is observable to me and my eyes.
Right.
If I can't observe it, it doesn't exist. So they rule out God as an explanation. Therefore, the fact that there's different things on Earth means they all had to come from the same place.
Right.
But they call it a fact, even though it's not a fact. Yeah. It's just, it's a fact only if their presuppositions are true, which they aren't.
And this is why we're saying that Sagan was being dishonest when he was saying that they're going to distinguish speculation from fact. And then these are facts, right? Yeah, you're right. It's their perspective. There is no other option. If you block out creationism, what other option have you got? It's their collection of facts about the opposite. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Kent Hovind is a creationist, and he said once, evolutionists literally want us to believe in fairy tales, that the frog really did turn into the prince, it just took a few billion years to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really good, but sure.
We're going to see some good news in a couple of weeks about people who don't support evolution. And we'll look at what Jesus said about creation. What did he say? Anyway, I'll pray, and then if we want to talk about some more, that's fine. Lord, we thank you for the creation that you have given to us that we can enjoy. As we look this time of year, as we mentioned, the beauty, how things all work together, and yet we marvel that it is so intricate. We also thank you for the opportunity we have to live in it, but also to share your glory with those who don't see it. May that be our response. Not to look at this as just another part of creation, but something that you have given to us to glorify you. In Jesus' name we pray.